Amazing how quickly prayer can work, huh? You know, one of the things that's been coming up a couple of times, and especially on Wednesday night, for those of you who have been with us on Wednesday night, is how does God speak to us? And this is just an aside, a digression, a rabbit trail, but I just had to tell you this, that, you know, it was asked of me several times in counseling sessions, but also on Wednesday night, there was a general question of, how does God talk to us? Do you hear an audible voice? You know, is there some analog of a burning bush? Does the clouds part? I mean, it's not a frivolous question. It's a serious question. Because we hear people expressing the way that God speaks to them all the time. And then when God doesn't speak to us in that way, or we don't experience those same sensations, we wonder, you know, what's wrong with me? You know, why doesn't God speak to me? And all those sorts of things go through our heads. And I was trying to explain how God speaks to me. And yesterday morning, I had one of those moments where I just knew that I knew that God was speaking to me. And I was sitting down to start preparing this message. And I basically had put the main notes down and I knew what I was going to talk about. And I have a friend. He's an old guy. He's in his mid-70s right now. And his name is George. And he was homeless for a good part of his life. He calls it his time being a bum. And he looks weathered and wizened, and he's completely white, and he's got this straggly beard, and he's missing a front tooth. And he is the most amazing man you'll ever meet. Deep thinker, wonderful guy, great sense of humor. And we have had the privilege of meeting every Wednesday with a small group for several years now. And we just recently disbanded that because things were just getting too crazy, and it was hard for everybody. But earlier in the week, beginning of the week, Monday, Tuesday, I got a brown manila envelope from George, and I looked inside, and it was several articles. And that's one of the ways that we always talk to each other, was, you know, trading articles and things that we were interested in. And he mailed them to me, and I didn't have time to read them. And I put it aside, and it sat on my desk, And I had just gotten to the point where my notes were kind of down, and the computer was doing a virus scan anyway, so I had some time to kill. And so I think I want to take a look at what George sent me. And I am telling you, the two articles he sent me, he must have been reading my notes. They were exactly on point. And you're going to hear parts of what he sent me because I couldn't have scripted it better. I couldn't have researched it better if I tried. You want to know how God speaks to me? He speaks to me often in the things that can be interpreted as coincidence. He speaks to me in the things that can be rationalized away. He speaks to me in the little cracks between what we think we know and what we can easily dismiss. He speaks to me in that kind of voice. And it's up to me to connect the dots. It's up to me to see the hand of God and the infusion of the Spirit in moments like that. And I tell you, I just had to run down the hall and tell Marianne. And I was actually crying a bit because it is so wonderful to know that you've been touched in a way that nobody can tell you and nobody can take away from you. It's just yours. And yet, if you just blow the wrong way, it's like a puff of smoke that leaves you. You know, God speaks to us in those quiet moments that we can so easily let go. And I just want to encourage you that however God speaks to you is just the right way. And maybe it's going to be unique for every one of us, experienced just a little bit differently. But be attentive. Lean in to the things that seem like coincidence, that seem like happenstance or serendipity, and immerse yourself in those moments because those can be the most rewarding. The small things is where God comes through most clearly to me. And so here we are, the fourth step. You know, what was this all about? For those of you who may not have been with us yet, we're going through the 12 steps of AA. And why would we do that in a group of mixed group of normies and whatever else anybody is? And it's because we have come to the realization here that every one of us is recovering from something. Amen. All right, good. I got an amen. Everyone is recovering from something. Every one of us left childhood with behaviors that we put in place to mask, to numb, to distract us from the woundings that we had already received by such a tender age. You know, the traumas, the hurts, the abandonments, the betrayals that created in us compulsive behavior that we felt we needed to use and repeat in order just to cope, in order just to get through. We call them addictions. But we only call them addictions when they tend to be something with substance abuse or something with real, antisocial behavior, let's say, or self-destructive behavior. But some of us abuse things that are very socially acceptable and seem to be positive things. But if they're compulsions, if they are being used to mask us and keep us from delving into the actual truth about ourselves that is just too uncomfortable to deal with right now, then we need to recover from that. And the only way that that happens is through a process. You know, sometimes in the church we talk about a one-step process. Just pray to Jesus and you're a new creature in Christ. Just come to the saving relationship with Jesus and everything is changed in your life. And what you find most often later on is that no, the same patterns of behavior will reassert themselves if you don't go through the process. Jesus himself went through the process. And if that sounds striking to you, we'll talk about that a little bit later. But he was not immune. He went through the process as well. We all have to. And the first three steps that we've covered in the last 3 weeks are dealing with what we talked about last week as a serial surrender. We don't surrender all at once. Ever notice that? We surrender in bits and pieces. And things fall off of us like that image of the chunks of ice falling off the end of the glacier and sliding into the ocean. It feels sort of like that. We talked about the difference between giving up and surrender. Giving up, in a negative sense, the end of resistance, is not the same as surrender, true surrender, in a positive sense, which is the beginning of submission. Two very different things. What we are searching for is the beginning of submission. We are moving towards something positive and not simply running away from something negative. Running away from something negative that hasn't been resolved, hasn't been processed, will only create another bottom for you to hit, another place that you have to recover from. And so what the 12 steps allow us to do is to resolve those things and move toward true submission. The first step, I can't. I'm powerless against these compulsive behaviors. You know, my life is in ruins. My life is in chaos. The second step, God can. Recognizing that there is a God out there who cares enough and has the ability, the capability, and the desire to restore us to sanity. And the third step, let him. Right? Turning our will and our life over to the care of this God who loves us and cares for us in that way. Those three steps, serial surrender, each one taking us a step closer to admit our own powerlessness, is a huge piece of surrender. To admit that there's a power outside of ourselves that can and will help fix us and heal us, another piece of that surrender. To turn our lives and will over in a real way where that actually starts to change and transform us, another big piece of surrender. But when you think about those first three steps, they're all happening internally, aren't they? They're a changing of the worldview. They're a breaking up of the hard-packed ground of our lives that won't allow us to plant anything new. And once that soil is tilled and broken up, now it's time to plant something. And that's what the next 10 steps are about. They're about planting in something that will grow into a whole new direction for our lives. And the first step, well, I should say the fourth step after the first three, is the one that really starts to take us into the external work of actually doing something. You got to do something. You got to make a different choice and do something different if you ever want to end up someplace you haven't been before. And these steps are the ones that start to take us there. So, to make a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves is doing something. It's a first step. And it's a huge piece of surrender, if you want to think about it. Now, on first blush, making a moral inventory of ourselves, okay, that sounds like making a list of all the things I don't like about myself. All the things that I consider defects or flaws in myself. Okay, I can sit down and do that. You know, that's pretty easy. I can write all that stuff and then I can turn it in and see what kind of grade I get. But if that's the sum total of how we approach step four, nothing is really going to change. There are two key words in this step that transform everything about it, and that's searching and fearless. Those two words change this step, this exercise, from a mere mental exercise where we are just writing down or making lists, to an actual process of ruthlessly searching within ourselves to find out what's really there, to look in all the dark corners, to open all the doors that have been shut maybe for decades in our lives and see what's there, to really see the truth about ourselves. Fearless, you bet, because it's scary doing that stuff. It's frightening. It's so frightening that most of us don't ever really do this. To really look at ourselves, to really see what's there. You want to talk about surrender. What the fourth step is no more or less than the surrender of our victimhood. Have you ever thought of it that way? Surrendering our victimhood. As long as we've been wounded, as long as we've been wronged, as long as we've been traumatized, we're the victims. It's been done to us. Our reaction is understandable because we're victims. And as long as we're victims, we don't have any responsibility. Because it wasn't us that did this, it was somebody else. And as long as we don't have any responsibility, there's nothing that we can do about it. You know, as perverse as it may sound, being a victim, being miserable as a victim, is also comforting. You ever thought that? It's comforting because it absolves us from any of the responsibility to change. And what the fourth step does is force us to look at ourselves not as victims, but also as actors, as perpetrators, as the creators of our own situation. To see that we did something also to contribute to whatever is going on in our lives, whatever level of chaos there may be. We have to surrender our victimhood. And that's a difficult thing to do because we carry it around like a security blanket. We defend it fiercely. Many of us would rather be miserable than have to be responsible. And I'm not saying consciously. It's unconscious most of the time. But a searching and fearless fourth step is going to peel all that stuff back, pick at every scab, look under every rock, and find all the creepy crawly things that are there. I remember Peter Gabriel had a song called Digging in the Dirt. You know, it's like that. You're digging in the dirt, you're finding all the stuff that's there, and it's not a pretty process. But once we surrender our victimhood, then we are free to move on. And notice that the next four steps that really deal with this area are sliced out in very small bites. The first thing is just to make the moral inventory. The fifth step is to actually admit it to somebody else and to God. That's another serial surrender, isn't it? The next step is to actually take the admission and become entirely ready to ask God to change the defects in our character. That might sound like a strange step, but being entirely ready is huge. And the last step is actually asking God to make the changes in our lives. Tiny little steps, each one another part of that serial surrender. And wisely, it's broken up into those small steps, not throwing them all together because you won't have any effect from that, but doing each one in that succession is exactly what this is all about. And so this idea of laying down our victimhood is huge. You know, I've been doing a lot more counseling lately, and I've been loving it. It's wonderful. And in the counseling sessions where I get to talk to people about their lives, I'm finding that more and more of them, and this is human nature, are really focused on changing their circumstances or changing the character of the people with whom they live and interact before they feel they have any chance of being happy, before they have any chance of having the kind of life that they dream of having and want to have and are seeking to have through the counseling or any other methods or techniques that they're using. But they're looking outward. They're looking to change their spouse. If only my spouse was X dot, 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 whatever, then, you know, I could do this and that and the other thing. If only my husband, if only my wife, if only my job, if only my employer, my boss, my kids, you know, if only they could do this, then. And I keep trying to tell them that if you can't be happy now, you won't be happy then. Happiness is not true happiness. Let's clarify that a little bit. Not just an emotional high, but true baseline contentment, happiness. Being comfortable in your own skin has nothing to do with your external circumstances. And I really want to underscore that. Nothing to do with your external circumstances. That kind of contentment, that kind of baseline okayness is a choice that we make, a decision that we hold to be that way regardless of our circumstances. It's so important to know that. If we aren't willing to unilaterally go forth, regardless of our circumstances, regardless of who may be doing what to us, and make this decision and go in this direction, then when is it ever going to start? If we're waiting for conditions to be perfect and right, we'll be waiting till the second coming. I'm telling you right now, there's always going to be something that is not right. There's always going to be something that's pushing your button or yanking your chain. So if you're waiting for this time, stop waiting. Which is exactly what Jesus told us in his sort of coming out party in Mark 1:15, where he said, "The waiting is over. The kingdom is here. The kingdom is now." There is nothing to wait for. You decide when you want to enter kingdom. You decide when you're going to be better. There is no one and nothing to wait for. There's a guy that I'm working with right now, having a very difficult marriage. And in no way do I want to trivialize what you all may be going through, because I don't know what you're going through. And some of you are going through some really traumatic things, very difficult circumstances in your lives. And so is he. His marriage is very difficult. And he's crying out in all this anguish. And he keeps saying things like, you know, you just don't understand how it is. And you'd have to be here, you'd have to live here to understand why I'm going through what I'm going through. But everything I hear from him is just resentment and bitterness. Everything I hear from him is that he cannot do anything unless she responds, unless she does this, unless she does that. And when I try to talk him into trying to just go for it himself, then he's lamenting that she didn't respond the way that he wanted her to in that moment, and we're back to the races again, you know. And I'm trying to get him to understand that even though I may not know what you're going through entirely, because I'm not there, the way through the circumstances make that knowing irrelevant. It doesn't matter that I exactly know what he's going through, what any of you are going through, because the way through is always the same. And the way through has nothing to do with the circumstances. I hope he can get that at some point. Whether his marriage survives or not is not so much the issue as whether he can find the space and the fortitude to decide to be happy, to live his life as he wants to live it, because that's the best chance he'll ever have for his wife to respond and come back to him. See? No matter how bad it is, if he becomes the person that he wants her to be, that's the best chance that she will become the person that he wants her to be. The way through is always the same. I know it's difficult. I'm not saying that it's not. But that's life. What did Jesus mean when he said, "I am the way and the truth and the life, and no one comes to the Father but through me"? You want to experience the Father in your life, in your moments right now? You follow the way. What way? The way that Jesus showed us. The way that Jesus lived. The way of love. The way of other-centeredness. All of that is the way through, and it's always the same. Talking with another couple, and this time it was the wife who had the anger and the resentment against the husband. But you know, when we were talking, I could sense that she was just out of fight. She was just so done pushing this thing. And even though she was still feeling the anger and the resentment, I could tell that there was something just ready to break, like she was right at the corner and she could turn either way. And then the next week when we talked, she told me, she was able to find within herself just the ability to let it go. Just to be all right with it, just for a moment. Just to not focus on it anymore. Just to focus on something else. And it's amazing that the main sticking point between them suddenly was resolved. Isn't that amazing how that works? You know, I'm not going to tell you that it's quid pro quo. I'm not going to tell you if you will do this, then God will do that, because it doesn't work that way. But it seems like God always showing up at the 11th hour. You know how that works? You know, it's always the last place you look. Well, of course it's always the last place you look, because after you look, you stop looking. After you find it, you stop looking. But God showing up at the 11th hour there's something about finally releasing and letting go of the thing that you're holding on to so tightly that opens the door of possibility to something that you never saw coming from the sides, from a different direction. You know? It works kind of like that. The way through is always the same. And if we can begin by simply telling ourselves we're not going to be a victim anymore, that we are going to look within ourselves at the things that we can change and not constantly banging our heads against the things that we can't change, the doors of possibility will open up. One of the articles that George sent me was about the Warsaw Ghetto. And I don't know how many of you are familiar with what happened in Warsaw during World War II, but it was an incredible time in world history. And as Nazi Germany marched into Poland, one of the things that they were doing already within their own borders was systematically stripping the Jews of their rights. And the first thing that they did was strip them of their citizenship and of their rights under the law. The second thing they did was to move them into concentrated areas, either into ghettos, which were portions of a city dedicated to a minority group, or into actual concentration camps. And of course, the third stage was actual extermination as they moved through their plan of genocide. But after occupying Poland, moving into Warsaw, there were about 400,000 Jews living in Warsaw in 1939-1940. What the Nazis did was to segregate a section of the city and force all the Jews into that area. 400,000 people represented about a third, almost 40% actually, of the total population of Warsaw, and they stuck them into 4.5% of the city's area. Is that registering with you? 40% of the city's population jammed into 4.5% of the city's square miles or area. And they literally walled up that section of the city. They took the worst section of the city and built a wall around it. They put walls in the streets to separate the section from the Jewish side to the Aryan side. And they just walled them up and they left them in there. They rationed the food so that the Jews inside the Warsaw Ghetto were getting less than half the amount of calories that either Gentile Poles or Germans were getting. And so starvation, famine, and of course communicable diseases, especially typhus, were rampant in the ghetto. And the Jews were segregated to live there. They were not allowed out. They were not allowed to do many forms of work. And so all sorts of illegal activities had to crop up. The Jews weren't without their friends, though. Gentiles and Aryans, even Germans on the Aryan side, were helping them. They were smuggling things in. Do you know that children would go out by the hundreds every morning, 4- and 5-year-old children, that would go out and they would be given food and raw materials for some of the cottage industries that were happening within the ghetto, and they would smuggle them back in, sometimes carrying their own body weight in food and other supplies, you know? 4- or 5-year-old children doing this, you know, climbing through the walls, over the walls, getting out to the other side, coming back. Under those conditions, life was pretty much hell. I mean, you can imagine the density, the packed nature of the whole thing. But something really interesting happened in there. And gosh, you got to hand it to the Jews. They're an amazing people. That they have survived for 6,000 years as a recognizable people and are so creative and so industrious. Within the Warsaw Ghetto, a whole new culture sprung up and flourished. Even under the illegal activities and the watchful eye of the Nazi guards, they were able to create underground facilities, organizations of all sorts and types. They had underground hospitals to treat those who were afflicted. They had underground refugee centers. They had underground schools. They had an underground symphony orchestra. They had recreational facilities. They had libraries. They taught children in the way of Torah. And all of these little cottage industries sprung up that allowed them to create goods that they could smuggle out for money or for barter on the other side that the children would bring back. Sometimes some of the elder Jewish teachers would meet together in a cobbling basement someplace, and as they're making the shoes and cutting the leather, they're also discussing the things of God and the Torah. The human spirit was able to just leap even in the most difficult of circumstances. It was an amazing thing. And there is a rabbi who was able to get out of Warsaw in 1939 before it was closed down and locked down. His name is Abraham Joshua Heschel. And I want to read a little bit of what he has to say, because this will start to get you into the mindset of what these Jews, especially the Hasidic Jews, the ones who carried the mystical tradition from the earliest times of the Hebrew race into the present, what they were thinking about as they were going through these kinds of things. The most eloquent rabbi and writer of Hasidic mysticism, Abraham Joshua Heschel, left Warsaw in 1939 to become an important professor at the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York, and in the 1960s a vocal activist for integration. In prose full of cone-like paradoxes, epigrams, and parallels, such as, "Man is a messenger who forgot the message." Don't you love that? Pagans exalt sacred things, the prophets extol sacred deeds. I mangled that one. The search of reason ends at the shore of the known. The stone is broken, but the words are alive. Don't you love that? The stone is broken, but the words are alive. Alluding to the tablets of the law that were broken by Moses, but the words remain written on the hearts of the people. To be human is to be a problem, and the problem expresses itself in anguish. Heschel felt loyal to the presence of the ultimate in the commonplace. That's on your sheet if you want to take a look. He felt loyal to the presence of the ultimate in the commonplace, and that it's in doing the finite that we may perceive the infinite. "I have one talent," he wrote, "and that is the capacity to be tremendously surprised, surprised at life, at ideas. This is to me the supreme Hasidic imperative. Don't be old and don't be stale." Many people know that 30 to 40% of the world's Jews were killed during World War II, but not that 80 to 90% of the Orthodox community perished. 80 to 90%. Among them, many who had kept alive an ancient tradition of mysticism and meditation, reaching back to the Old Testament world of the prophets. "In my youth, growing up in a Jewish milieu," Heschel wrote of his childhood in Warsaw, "there was one thing we did not have to look for, and that was exaltation. Every moment is great. We were taught that every moment is unique. Every moment is great. Every moment is unique." The etymology of the Hebrew word for prophet, Navi, combines three processes: Navach, to cry out; Navah, to gush or flow; and Navuv, to be hollow. The task of this meditation was to open the heart, to unclog the channel between the infinite and the mortal, and rise into a state of rapture known as Mochin Gadlut, the great mind. "There is only one God," Hasidic teacher Avram Devi writes. As I read this, I realize there's the exact analog in the Christian tradition. And many of you have heard me talk about Brother Lawrence in here, because he's one of my all-time heroes. But Brother Lawrence, the cook in his monastery, learned that as he was just performing his duties as a cook, he found the ultimate in the commonplace. He was able to find God's presence in just the tiniest little moments that would be absolutely annoying, mundane, and brain dead to anybody else. And look what he writes. "We ought not to be weary of doing little things for the love of God, who regards not the greatness of the work, but the love with which it is performed. Our sanctification does not depend upon our changing our works, but upon doing that for God's sake, which commonly we do for our own. There is not in the world a kind of life more sweet and delightful than that of a continual walk with God. Those only can comprehend it who practice and experience it." Here's the key. You don't know what you don't know. And until you experience it and feel the realness of God's voice in your life, you don't even know what you're missing. But once you've experienced it, nobody can take that from you. Mother Teresa had a different way of putting it. She said, "In this life we cannot do great things for God. We can only do small things with great love." You know, everybody who really thinks about these things, everything who then experiences these things of God, comes to the same conclusion over and over and over again. This is where Jesus is leading us. This is what is trying to be happening here, if we would just let it happen. And then we have another rabbi, Rabbi Kalonymus Kalman Shapira. Now, here's a rabbi who did not leave Warsaw. When the Nazis came in, when they walled off the city, he had multiple chances to leave. He had people who were willing to smuggle him out. And even after he was taken from the ghetto into a concentration camp, he had another chance to leave, and he wouldn't do it. He stayed with his people. And everything we know of him comes from his sermon and a diary that was found in the rubble afterwards. He didn't leave. He stayed with his people. And the weak, the sick, the exhausted, the hungry, tortured, and insane all came to Rabbi Shapira for spiritual nourishment, which he combined with leadership and soup kitchens. How did he manage such feats of compassion while staying sane and creative? By stilling the mind and communing with nature. He writes, "One hears the teaching's voice from the world as a whole, from the chirping of the birds, the mooing of the cows, from the voices and tumult of human beings. From all these, one hears the voice of God. All our senses feed the brain, and if it diets mainly on cruelty and suffering, how can it remain healthy? Change that diet on purpose. Train mentally to refocus the mind, and one nourishes the brain. Rabbi Shapira's message was that even in the ghetto, common people could temper their suffering in this way, and not just monks, ascetics, or rabbis. Everybody can do this. We can do this. How do we do this, though, is the question that you should all be asking, and certainly I am asking. And here's what Rabbi Shapira has to say. The ideal way, Shapira taught, was to witness one's thoughts and correct negative habits and character traits. A thought observed will start to weaken, especially negative thoughts, which he advised his students not to enter into, but examine dispassionately. If that's not sounding like the fourth step, then we're not getting things across. If they sat on the bank watching the stream of thoughts flow by, without being swept away by them, they might achieve a form of meditation that was silencing the conscious mind, called hashkata. He also preached sensitization to holiness, a process of discovering the holiness within oneself. The Hasidic tradition, including mindfully attending to everyday life, as 18th century teacher Alexander Susskind taught, when you eat and drink, you experience enjoyment and pleasure from the food and drink. Arouse yourself every moment to ask in wonder, what is this enjoyment and pleasure? What is this that I am tasting? Being mindful, immersing yourself in the present, taking yourself out of yourself, letting your thoughts go by, those thoughts that continue in a rut in your brain that are creating the habits and the patterns in your life that always take you to the same place and the same compulsive behavior. The ideal way is to witness one's thoughts to correct negative habits and character traits. Creating the moral inventory is the way that this is accomplished. It's the first step. To see yourself as a sum total of what you do and what you think, but that's not you. To step away from that, to let that flow by, is exactly what's going on here. And then, from the Christian tradition, our own C.S. Lewis, he writes a wonderful little essay here, or part of a larger essay called God in the Dock. And I want to read a part of it to you. And just sit back and listen. He has such a wonderful way with words. But he says this, "I suppose I may assume that 7 out of 10 of those who read these lines are in some kind of difficulty about some other human being. Either at work or at home, either the people who employ you or those whom you employ, either those who share your house or those whose house you share, either your in-laws or parents or children, your wife or your husband, are making life harder for you than it need be even in these days. It is hoped that we do not often mention these difficulties, especially the domestic ones, to outsiders, but sometimes we do. An outside friend asks us why we are looking so glum, and the truth comes out. On such occasions, the outside friend usually says, 'But why don't you just tell them? Why don't you go to your wife or husband or father or daughter or boss or landlady or lodger and have it all out? People are usually reasonable. All you've got to do is make them see things in the right light. Explain it to them in a reasonable, quiet, and friendly way. And we, whatever we say outwardly, think sadly to ourselves, he doesn't know X.'" We do. We know how utterly hopeless it is to make X see reason. Either we've tried it over and over again, tried it till we are sick of trying it, or else we've never tried it because we saw from the beginning how useless it would be. We know that if we attempt to have it all out with X, there will be either a scene or else X will stare at us in blank amazement and say, I don't know what on earth you're talking about. Or just, which is perhaps worst of all, X will quite agree with us and promise to turn over a new leaf and put everything into a new footing. And then 24 hours later, it will be exactly the same as X has always been. You know, in fact, that any attempt to talk things over with X will shipwreck on the old fatal flaw in X's character. Even if you became a millionaire, your husband would still be a bully, your wife would still nag, or your son would still drink, or you'd still have to have your mother-in-law live with you. I said that when we see how all our plans shipwreck on the characters of the people we have to deal with, we are in one way seeing what it must be like for God. But only in one way. There are two respects in which God's view must be very different from ours. In the first place, He sees, like you, how all the people in your home or your job are in various degrees awkward or difficult. But when He looks into that home or factory or office, He sees one more person of the same kind. The one you never do see. I mean, of course, yourself. That is the next great step in wisdom, to realize that you are also just that sort of person. You also have a fatal flaw in your character. All the hopes and plans of others have again and again shipwrecked on your character, just as your hopes and plans have shipwrecked on theirs. It is no good passing this over with some vague general admission, such as, of course, I know I have my faults. It's important to realize that there is some really fatal flaw in you, something which gives the others just that same sense of feeling of despair, which their flaws give you. And it is almost certainly something that you don't know about, like what the advertisements call halitosis, which everyone notices except the person who has it. But why, you ask, don't the others tell me? Believe me, they have tried to tell you over and over again, and you just couldn't take it. Perhaps a good deal of what you call their nagging or bad temper or queerness are just their attempts to make you see the truth. And even the faults that you do know, you don't know fully. You say, I admit I lost my temper last night, but the others know that you're always doing it, that you are a bad-tempered person. You say, I admit I drank too much last Saturday, but everyone else knows that you are a habitual drunkard. This is the one way in which God's view must differ from mine. He sees all the characters. I see all except my own. Some people say it is morbid to always be thinking of one's own faults. That would all be very well if most of us could stop thinking of our own without soon beginning to think about those of other people. For unfortunately, we enjoy thinking about other people's faults. And in the proper sense of the word morbid, that is the most morbid pleasure in the world. We don't like rationing, which is imposed upon us, but I suggest one form of rationing which we ought to impose on ourselves. Abstain from all thinking about other people's faults unless your duties as a teacher or a parent make it necessary to think about them. Whenever the thoughts come unnecessarily into one's mind, why not simply shove them away and think of one's own faults instead? For there, with God's help, one can do something. Of all the awkward people in your house or job, there is only one whom you can improve very much. That is the practical end at which to begin. And really, we'd better. The job has to be tackled someday, and every day we put it off will make it harder to begin. What, after all, is the alternative? You see clearly enough that nothing, not even God with all His power, can make X really happy as long as X remains envious, self-centered, and spiteful. Be sure there is something inside you which, unless it is altered, will put it out of God's power to prevent your being eternally miserable. While that something remains, there can be no heaven for you, just as there can be no sweet smells for a man with a cold in the nose and no music for a man who is deaf. It's not a question of God sending us to hell. In each of us, there is something growing up which will of itself be hell unless it is nipped in the bud. Can I read that again? It is not a question of God sending us to hell. In each of us there is something growing up which will of itself be hell unless it is nipped in the bud. The matter is serious. Let us put ourselves in His hands at once, this very day, this very hour. Man, fourth step is all over that. We want to remain victims. We want to look at everyone else's faults so that we can remain absolved of having to change anything in and of ourselves. But once we can see ourselves as fellow actors in this drama, in this tapestry of our lives, that each of us are equally contributing to everything that's going on, you know, that our faults, our eccentricities, our difficulties are affecting negatively the people around us, the people in our blast zone. We don't mean to hurt them. We just do, because that's what we've got to give, and they're doing it to us. And in all of that stuff that's going on, the only thing that we can change is our own choices. And the only way we can start to make our choices different is to have the awareness that there is a choice to be made, that there is a reason to make the choice in the first place. We don't have to live in the ghetto. We don't have to be miserable and live in that place. We can leave the ghetto anytime we want. It's not like Hotel California where you can check out but you can never leave. Here you can leave anytime you want, regardless of whether you check out. It's our choice. It's what we can do. The awareness that there is something to do is that first step, the next step in the serial surrender that is taking place. And if we really will make a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves, if we really will be brave enough to see the truth about ourselves in all its detail, in all its unlovely lights, then we can begin. We can knock down the walls of our own personal ghetto and leave, move into the bright sunlight of God's presence. Let's pray. Father, if this was easy, everyone would be doing it. We know that. Help us to break through the things that are easy for us personally, to stretch ourselves into the things that are so difficult, the things that are uniquely difficult for us and the things that are difficult for all of us as men and women. You know what those things are. You have infinite patience with us. We know that. And if we don't know that, help us to understand. You're not holding a lighted fuse over our heads, asking us to do anything within a certain time frame, but only desiring that we would come into your presence and know what that means as quickly as possible so we can enjoy our moments together. Help us to find that in you. Help us to have the courage to look deep within and see ourselves as we are so that we can move forward with you. Thank you for giving us the life and the breath, the minds and the hearts to be able to do any of this, Father. We thank you for all the gifts that you give us in Jesus' name.